Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey's Straight No Chaser. Boy, do I have somebody on here this evening. This couple is absolutely fabulous. So don't start giggling. So, but until I introduce them, I'm going to give you some of my regular housekeeping kind of notes so that everyone will know where they are, how they can call in if you have any questions. You know, if you want to hear this again, it's archived. So you know that you are on blogtalkradio.com/ S is in Sam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, and the number 2. Then you can call in at 516-453-6063. We have been doing this program now for about a year and a half, and I have had the pleasure of talking to so many of my wonderful, wonderful friends and new people that I did not know before they came on the program. But I'm going to tell you now that these two people I have known for decades, and in particular, the female member of this company, I think we're born in the same family in another world. That's how much there is similarity for both of us. Let me just tell you about them. I'm going to start, though, with the male counterpart, because I think that Kenneth McDonald is one of the most wonderful men that I know. He is a wonderful husband, wonderful business manager for NJTAP. But before I get into that, let me say to the whole audience that he is fabulous because he has been married to my friend all these years, and she's like me, and I know that we are not easy. So I love you, Kenneth McDonald, for sticking in with my friend all these years. But besides the fact that you have been a wonderful, unconditionally supportive husband, you've had your own career, and we're going to start a little bit. We're going to ask a little bit more questions behind what we're starting at. But we're going to start when you began your career as a volunteer bookkeeper and financial consultant and chair of the volunteer committees, and that's in 1994. You have an MSW in social work, and I from Fordham University. And a lot of these things are things that I did not know. I cannot wait to ask you about some of the experiences that you've had in your social work and what that whole thing means. You've done enormous work in the charity world. You have been a person that has done work at the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, at Calvary Hospital. You have been a people person so much of your life, and your experiences show that. And then when you retired, you devoted your time to assist my friend, and I cannot ever thank you more for that, because she needs all the help she can get. And that's you nice. Have been unconditional for her. And then there is my friend, Miss Deborah Mitchell. Ms. Deborah Mitchell, besides being, and she won't probably own it now, and I hope she does, a TAP master, because that is what she is, has been in this position probably most of her life, but for the 28 years of her life, she was the founder and artistic director of the New Jersey Tap Ensemble. You have seen her tap in so many different performances. And she was appeared on Broadway and in Paris in Black and Blue. She was in the movie Cotton Club. She did the PBS Great Performances for Black and Blue. She did international tours with Cab Calloway, and she partnered with this lovely, the lovely Jermaine Goodson as the Rhythm Queen. Now that is a part of her performance. Now let's go back and talk about how she had got awards for being administratively aggressive and successful for New Jersey Tap. New Jersey Tap has had awards, including the Flo Burt Award in 2007 from the New York Committee to Celebrate National Dance, the Hofer Award in 2007 from the American Tap Dance Foundation, and among other things, she has been the subject of publications like Tap Dancing America by Constance Ballas Hill, and she has been in the documentary Gotta Move, Women in Tap. Now, I could go on, but we only have an hour. So without any more of her credits, I would like both of them to come on the air and say hello to everyone. Deborah and Ken, please. Say hello to the audience that we have here on Lenny Godfrey Straight No Chaser. Hello, you all.
Well, hello, hello, hello. We're so happy to be here. Kenny sitting right here with me, hugging me.
Yes,
them.
Yes, hello. I can't wait to be able to share some thoughts with you and with the audience.
And with all that introduction going on, I said, oh, who are these people? Oh, I want to meet them too. I mean, it was so, oh, my goodness, it just means so much. But we are so thrilled and honored to be here, honestly. It means, because, you know, Miss Lenny is my dear, dear, dear friend, and we go back a long, long way. And I really, friend is not the right word. I have to call her my sister, because that's exactly how I feel. And Ken and I just love her. I can't say enough about it. So, and then to ask us to be here tonight, the two of us are just beaming. You can't see it yet, but we are.
Yes, you'll see it on the Zoom when we do the after show after show. Now, I want you to think a little bit, Ken, while I ask Debbie this question. Debbie, I know that you are from St. Louis. Yes.
Yes.
So I want you, now, Ken, I want you to think about this, because I'm going to come to you. I'm going to ask Debbie first. I want you to tell me a little bit. First of all, let's talk about your mother, because we talked about your mother. We used to talk about mothers before our mothers passed away. How
absolutely
supportive and how wonderful she was, and how it all started for you in St. Louis, and how the arts really entered into your life as a young person. Can you give me some of that information? Yes. Please.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's a favorite subject of mine. I've often said my mother was a woman ahead of her time. As a young woman, she used to laugh and say to me that she knew that I would dance. She's the reason why I got into tap dance in the first place, because she used to say that it was when she carried me, I was always moving. And then after I was born, her grandmother, who was so special in her life, she'd tell her grandmother, this baby needs a ball and a chain to keep up with her. In those days, that was an expression that they used. But it was due to, you know, her vision. She was always, and both my parents were big proponents of education. But my mother, as a young woman, because she was only 21 years old when I was born, as a young woman, saw that there were things in me that maybe others didn't see, and I tell you, she always, there was so much love in my family. People, I was born, you see, I grew up, my childhood was in the 50s, so therefore St. Louis at that time was still in the grips of segregation. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I was born, and I, you know, when I did my oral history, I did some more background, you know, going back to my roots. I was actually born at Homer G. Phillips Hospital, which was the only hospital in St. Louis that would serve African Americans. You could not just go wherever you wanted. That was the only hospital. But a lot of this I didn't know when I was growing up, because due to the love and support that my mother and father gave me as a child, I was, I often say, very sheltered from a lot of the viciousness and the ugliness of racism. It was there. And in fact, it really entered in with my dancing, because when my mom said, she knew right away, she would put me into tap. Now, I had an older sister. The two of us went into dance school. I was about six. And my mom sent my older sister into ballet. But she told the instructor, this one has to go, is going to be the tap dancer. There's no way she is going to stand still at a bar. So I want her to go into. And sure enough, I was, my mother said very early, you could see that it was with, it was just in my spirit, in my soul. But what my mother recognized was in the studio, now don't forget, this goes back to what was happening in St. Louis with race, with the races. My mother noticed, consistently moved me to the back of the class. And she said she saw that I was so, my mother watched. She wasn't one of these, you know, dance moms that opened the door and all that kind of thing. She was watching me, and she said she noticed no matter what happened, I really excelled, but the instructor kept consistently put me in the back row, because at that time, you know, black was not beautiful, and therefore my peers would be in the front. So my mom decided that she would take me, she took me out of the dance school, and she, and even that was probably our most, the most heartbreaking thing for me, because I loved it so much. And my mom didn't say to me, I'm taking you out because of racism. She just said, you know, we can come back to tap at some other time. Right now we're going to concentrate on education. But she took the shoes away from me and put them, Lenny, in a closet. Now, this is so funny. She put the shoes in a closet. Now, don't forget, I'm about 7 years old. And I was so hurt by it. But I, you know, had to do what mom said. But don't you know, my mother said one afternoon, she heard all this noise. She couldn't figure out where it was coming from. Well, I found the shoes in the closet. I was tap dancing in the closet. So she said, this baby, right? She said, open the closet. I was in there tap dancing. She said, okay. She said, well, I'm going to tell you again. You will be able to dance, but we're just not going to do this right now. But she said then, she knew, and it's a really sweet story that Ken and I talk about all the time, and I mentioned this. If you fast forward many, many years, when my mother, whom I made sure saw me in Black and Blue on Broadway, she said when she saw me on stage with the joy and the gleam in my eye, and just, she said, you know what? You were 7 years old all over again. Mm-hmm. And she said, and I said, my baby is where she needs to be. So, and this comes after getting my undergraduate degree and my master's degree. But, you know, I say many times that what's in a child's heart and in their spirit, that's not something you're going to crush. If it's meant for them, it's meant for them. But exactly. I give her credit that she made sure education was important. And when I told her I wanted to go into the theater, she said, you've got your master's degree. And she was a proponent. It's four girls in my family, three of my sisters and myself. My mother always believed that each one of us would be able to stand on their own, be able to get a job, be able to take care of ourselves, because she said, I don't want you in this world to have to depend on anybody. You'll be able to take care of yourself. So even though I really did not get back into tap until I was a young woman, very young, a young adult, I have to say that the education that I got has really served me all of my life, and I am still using it. So, you know, I give her credit. She was so ahead of her time, you know, in saying, I want you as a young woman to be able to stand on your own and do what you need to do. So, you know, it goes back, you know, to all of the love I was really a product of a lot of love, and I know that that's why today it often pains me when I see young people who I know need love, because that's where it starts. You know, I was very poor. And even though I'm talking about my mom, my dad was a fantastic guy. I often say I did not get much of his DNA because he was one of the first African American men to graduate from St. Louis University with a degree in accounting. And I often laugh. I say, that's one thing I did. You know, don't bring figures to me. That's why Ken is here. Don't bring figures to me because I'm not too good with that. You know, I can do creative things now, you know. But when it comes to between the two of them, they were a great team too, you know. So
I think the similarities that we share, and I'm coming to you, Ken, but the similarities that we share we had parents that were very similar in their support system of us and recognized very early that there was potential for us to be something. They didn't know quite what we were going to be, but they were going to make sure that the avenues were open for us. And I think those of us who have that, that's why we all kind of get along. And we're very fortunate because those kind of traditions I don't think they're as prevalent now the way they were there. There's a different sense about it now, you know. But I totally appreciate it. And really, I can see some of having talked to you when your mother was alive and then after she passed away and all the stories we exchanged, I see that so much. Now I'm going to go to Ken. Now, Ken, you need to tell me how it all began with you. Where did it all start? Where are you a native of? And how... Because we didn't get to Debbie how she got to New York. We just got her tapping in the closet at 7. So we're going to make that journey. Tell me, where did it start for you? And did the arts come into your life early or did it come into your life a little bit later? Talk to me a little bit about that, Ken.
I was born in my parents' house. I was born in Staten Island, and my mom had to delivered me, I think, on the second floor of the house where we were. I was the baby of the family. Now, I had an older sister who was about 8 or something years older than me, and she's passed away. And then I had a brother who was about 5 years ahead of me, and he's passed away. And then I had a sister who was about 3 years older than me, and she's still living. She's in kind of an independent living down in North Carolina, so she can be with one of her children. Mm-hmm. But anyway, for me in Staten Island, I was a very extremely quiet person. And one of the reasons for the quietness is I stuttered. And fact, I stuttered in grammar school, high school, and college. And it prevented me in really getting a good education because I was afraid to ask questions because the classmates would laugh at me. That was the underlining thing. But we had a house, as Debbie is saying, with her. Mom and Dad were very loving and very much, and we're Catholics. And they always went to Mass on Sunday, and my father went to Mass frequently during Lent at about 6 o'clock, 6:30 in the morning. He'd be going to Mass, so we had a good religious background for us also. Now, when I got into high school, I had started to play a little tennis. And I say that because tennis became a very big thing for me. And especially with the being quiet and having the stuttering problem, you look to something you can achieve. And I was able to achieve something in tennis that I to develop early. And we got for Staten Island at that time, we're talking 85 now. So that was my schooling, high school. I think I graduated high school in 54, college in 58, and I guess in 50 was grammar school. But I started this tennis bit, and it really consumed my life during high school. Mm-hmm. And I used to walk. It's about a mile walk back and forth to school, to the high school that I went to. It was a Catholic school, and the grammar school was a Catholic school and everything. And then I got a scholarship to college, and I went to Fordham University. And so I, again, kind of excelled in tennis there, and I played squash, which is a game similar to tennis. It's played indoors. I did both of those in college and did very well. And then at the end of college, and I had belonged to one religious organization. I had belonged there for 4 years. I was in the glee club for 3 years and so on. So I did participate in extracurricular activities besides the studies. But then when it came to what I was going to do, I decided at the end I wanted to be a priest. So I checked with people, and of course, being in the Jesuit university, which is Fordham, they got me in touch with the right person and so on. And so then I did follow that up by going to the seminary. And I studied and did well and graduated and was ordained at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, and sent to Staten Island to a parish which was right near the Verrazano Bridge. And so I was basically there for 15 years. From 64, I was ordained, 1964, to 79. And then I had some struggles, and I felt I needed companionship and so on. And I felt I was not getting enough support from the priesthood or the diocese itself. It's kind of being Staten Island being the smallest of the boroughs, I think. They send them out there hoping that they won't get into trouble or all this kind of stuff. But anyway, I did well with what I did. But I wasn't pleased with all of the support I had from the diocese. It's like they forgot me. I never once met the cardinal who was running the diocese and technically was my boss. Never once in 15 years did I have a meeting with him. Until I was ready to leave. And all of a sudden, they got interested in me, and they were trying to do certain things to stall, to try to make me come back. But at that point, I was determined, and I followed through. I left in 1979, and then I stayed in Jersey for a few years, and then when I got my MSW during this period of time, and then I got the job working for the state, dealing with children that are having problems. And so you deal with the families and you deal with the children, and lo and behold, one day in 1983, and it was in February, and I'm not good with dates, but I'm very good with this one, and it was right around Valentine's Day. Before it, and I had to go to one of the what would we call them, daycare centers that the children would be going to during the days, and they would be there with their parents. Mm. And I go there this particular day with a couple of students. And then all of a sudden I see this little black beauty who was Deborah.
Well,
and I did not have any, how would you say, support or understanding of the art until I met Deborah. And after I've been through so many really very good experiences in life and has grown up, then I was able to easily support her because I knew how to work with people. So that kind of prepared me for helping her out, because that's one thing that Deborah and I did together, that we worked together. One would help the other. She would help me if something that I was involved with, and I would help her if there was a possibility of helping. And the other thing that was that I had developed is a strong spiritual life. I really enjoyed praying, and I continued to pray as an individual, and that has continued with me throughout my life with Deborah. The importance of God in our life, and the importance of beginning each day with prayer. Not simply an Our Father, Hail Mary, but prayer that would last about 45 minutes or so. But this is how I got started.
Well, that's an incredible story. Now, I've known you all this time, and I don't remember ever really knowing exactly how the two of you just kind of met. Debbie, you were...
Well, he left something out. I'll tell you.
Okay. I was going to say, there's something, there's a trip from St. Louis to New York that I've got to get in there. And understand now, we only have about 25 minutes left, so you all got to appreciate this now. Come on.
Okay, I'm going to help you, right? Listen, I'm going to help you right now. One of the things he did not mention is, you know, how sweet and smooth operator this man is. He's a, we love, if he loves you, he loves you. There's no pretense or anything. But let's get back, before I tell you about coming from St. Louis to New York, when he's talking about when he met me, this he was placing children, as he said, challenged children at the daycare center. I happened to be working at the daycare center, but in a different department. I was the new person. There was a resource center that had been established because at the time I was actually doing the Cotton Club motion picture. But unlike a lot of my peers, I was making sure that that money, because I was living on my own. I was not married at that time. I was living alone, and I wanted to be sure that I could get into my dance training properly. I really wanted to train. So at that time, I was really doing the Cotton Club late at night with Mr. Henry Letang. But during the day, I was working as the social worker because my master's is in social work. I was working in a resource center. It was a new position, and they needed someone to come in. And after the children had been placed by Mr. McDonald or whoever was placing the children, after the children were placed, their parents were very young and needed resources. So I was doing things like helping parents with their GED or finding clothes for young women to go for on an interview or job, et cetera, et cetera. The day that Mr. McDonald came in, I was at my desk. And I was furious because they did not give me a telephone to do this job. Everything was new. So anytime I had to make a phone call, I had to walk outside of the resource center. Now, I'm sitting there aggravated, and this gentleman is at my desk, and my head is down looking at figures and trying to figure things out. And he said, sir, I'm sorry, but I can't help you right now. Not looking at him. I said, I cannot help you right now. I really have no phone, and I have much, it's before cell phones. I have much to do. And he said, take your time. So I kept on doing what I was doing or whatever. So at the second time, I said, you know, I'm really, really sorry. Hold on. He said, you know, without me looking up, Lenny, he says, you know, they told me that this young woman was running the resource center and that she was so efficient at what she's doing. It has made such a difference in the lives of these young parents. They told me so much about what you're doing, but what they didn't tell me was how beautiful she was.
Oh, that, Jen McDonald.
Wait, that was, see, that was, if I tell you, you didn't tell you that. That was the moment that I stopped what I was doing. Vanity, vanity, vanity.
Yes.
I looked up and I said, excuse me, what is your name? Well, to make a long story short, the rest is history. But, you know, my coming, he's talking about, you know, where you're living. After I got my master's, I told you my mother told me, once you get your degrees, you can go do anything you want. And I was dying to get back into dance. And I wanted to be in New York. So when I made coming into New York, this was where I had a relationship that didn't work out well, but I had enough education and money to be on my own. And that's when I was referred to Henry Letang if I wanted to tap. So that's why you have to kind of go backwards to go forward. But I couldn't wait to tell you how we met. It was so beautiful. Now, women say this all the time, but I said to him, I said, you know what? I have to continue working, but I'll give you my phone number and we can continue this conversation. Now, you know, women all the time say, I've never done this before, but it was true. I've never given my phone number to a man I just met. I literally walked off the street, okay? But he was so special. His vibe was so beautiful. I said, well, let's continue this. I gave him my phone number. He called me when I got home. We must have talked honestly for at least 5 hours on the phone. Ridiculous. And then the sun came up on us talking. And that was the beginning of our dating and our little relationship together. And we actually dated 4 years before we were married. And he proposed at the Eiffel Tower in Paris. when I was doing Black and Blue. So I'm telling you, it was like a fairy tale. You know, Lenny, you know from the theater stage, I still had on my makeup and my hair was still messed up from being in a wig, blah, 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 blah. And he says, "You look beautiful. Let's go to dinner." And I said, "I can't go looking like this." He said, "You look beautiful to me." It was snowing. I had on boots. I didn't have on the right dress. So we went to the Eiffel Tower, and La Belle France at the top of the tower. We opened the door, and it was magic with candles and a little table in the corner. And that's where he proposed. So I'm telling you, it was wonderful. Just great.
But for me,
go ahead. Were you going to ask me?
No. Finish. But for you, go ahead.
It was true. I tell people all the time. I said it really was magic. But he's right. Now I grew up in the Baptist Church, and I never converted to Catholicism. But the two of us have such a bond with our faith that we feel like there's nothing we can't do together. And it shows up in everything that we do. With the company didn't even get started until 94. So, you know, you can see, you know, when in 83, that's when I was doing the Cotton Club. And I was and that was one of the things that got him. One night he called. And I was leaving the resource center, going to Queens to the Astoria Studios. That's where they were filming the Cotton Club.
Yeah, that's where they were doing Cotton Club, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's right. And when he called me one night about maybe, 9 or 10 o'clock, I didn't answer. And he thought, this young woman be at this hour. You know, so he said he called again, and he got worried. Well, of course, he didn't know. So when he asked me, where would you be at that hour? I was staying on the set with Henry LaTang until 1 o'clock in the morning. And then I would leave, come home, sleep real fast, and go back to the resource center. So I told him, I said, I'm not at home at night because I'm filming a movie. He said, "What do you mean? What movie?" And I said, "Well, I'm a dancer. I'm in the Cotton Club." He couldn't believe it. He said, "Oh, my, you know, it's just funny how life throws you together." You know what I mean?
I'm speechless in that normally I have all these questions to ask the guests, but you all have really answered a lot of what I was going. No, it's been wonderful because, the story just unfolded. It was just like peeling an onion. You just unfold one layer after another layer after another layer. But I am going to ask you a couple of questions. That's absolutely fabulous. And I do know about that fairy tale relationship that happened in the business. What do you think about when you hear this name, Deborah? Bubba Gaines.
Oh, it makes me smile. I'm telling you, this is like... There are a few what I call truly great men in my life, my father, my husband, and Bubba Gaines and Leonard Oxley. But Bubba Gaines was my friend. He was my teacher, mentor, confidant. You know, he's with me all the time, especially when I'm in the studio. I have a little phrase that I use all the time that Ken loves, the ghost of Gaines. He's always there because everything he taught me, he was a fabulous such a fabulous dancer. Had such
Tell the audience what he did. Tell them about a little bit about Bubba, just so that they understand.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, Bubba Gaines was born in 1912 in Waycross, Georgia. He danced on street corners and in carnivals and various things. He was one of eight children, the only boy. And his father made sure that he had as much of an education as he could at that time. But he loved danced on street corners, met two other young men in his lifetime called James Hutchinson and Pi Russell. The three of them together became the three Dukes, the aristocrats of dancing. And Bubba used to say that, now this, when they were very young, they toured everywhere. He was with Lena Horne. He danced with all the great bands, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, you name it. He started the Cotton Club with Bill Robinson and all. He was with the greats, but he was great himself. Today, people think of him as one of the copacetics, but his career started so much sooner than that when he was a young man and danced all over the world. And I did not meet Bubba. It was truly divine intervention, my meeting Bubba, because when I was taking classes at Clark Center, which was in New York, with Henry's teachers, I was dating a young man at that time who was painting dancers. And we were going out, so he said, you know, let's go out New Year's Eve, 1979. And I said, okay. So make a long story short, he was supposed to pick me up at Clark Center. But I was still in my warm-up clothes. And he said, you know, instead of us going out, where you need to go, Deborah, is to the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where some old guys are going to be tap dancing, but they are the best in the business. And I said, who are they? He said, just go to. So I got in my car the next day, and I drove to the Brooklyn Academy of Music. I got there late at night. It was so far away from my home that I was afraid to come back home, so I slept in my car that night. And the next morning when the garbage men opened up the back door of the Brooklyn Academy of Music, I slipped in, and I got into the auditorium and fell asleep. I sat there until voices woke me up about 11 o'clock in the morning, and I jumped up with my tap shoes in my purse, and they hit the floor. And a gentleman on the stage asked, who's out there? So, of course, I was petrified, and I said, just me. He said, come on up here. Who is just me? When I went on the stage, he said, what are you doing here? I said, I came here because my friend told me some old guys would be here tap. He said, well, old guys, introduce yourselves to the little lady. That was Honey Cole, Buster Brown, Faith Roberts, Fayard Nicholas, Charles Cookie Cook, and the young man and the gentleman in the back said, my name is Bubba Gaines. And I said, who? He was the only one who was rather quiet. So I couldn't quite get his name. And I asked again, I said, who are you? He said, Leslie Bubba Gaines. But all my friends call me Bubba. And why are you here? Why are you not in school? And I told him that I didn't hear what I wanted out of the dance schools. I heard something different. So the man at that time said to me, come to me what you hear. Well, I tried. And then he said, okay. He did a step in front of me, and I said, that's what I hear. He said, well, let me tell you this. I'm going to come over to, where do you live? And I told him Newark. He said, I'm going to come to Newark and check out your feet. In the meantime, he told me to come back the next day to the concert, which is called Great Feats of Feet, and that I had carte blanche to see him in anything he was dancing in. Fast forward, he came to Newark, as he said. He checked out my feet. He told me that's when he introduced what he did all his life was the dance with the jump rope. And that's a real special story because his partner who taught him the jump died from an overdose. And he asked, when I was on the stage dancing, and he said to me, she stopped me, and he said, can you jump with a jump rope? I said, sure. He said, can you do a time step? And he said, I want you to do that time step you're doing and jump this rope. So I said, okay, fine. I did it. The moment I did it, his eyes began to water, and he looked away from me, and I thought I had done something wrong. So he said, you don't know me. He said, but all my life with the aristocrats of dancing all overseas, my partner was the best in the business with the jump rope. He was fast. He was adorable. He had a smile that you would never forget. He said, and he used to joke and say to me, oh, Bubba, everything I do, you're going to see again. And Bubba said he would say, oh, man, you know, nobody's going to do that again. Well, the night that they were to go on stage, his partner with the jump rope was in the dressing room. Bubba was called to the dressing room. He had overdosed. And Bubba said he was had never felt that kind of pain until he saw his partner lying there dead from cocaine or whatever he took. But he said, I'll never forget, saw you so easily jumping with the rope and smiling. He said, he was right. I saw him again. And that was the beginning of a magnet. And there's so much more to it. But what he did after that was he went into the studio with me in Fayetteville. There was a dance studio called Fayetteville in New York where all tap dancers would work out. And Bubba took me into Fayetteville 3 and 4 times a week for hours. And he would, now anybody who knows about dance knows you have to pay for dance lessons. You can't just go into the studio. You got to pay. So one afternoon, after about 3 weeks of this, I said, Bubba, I said, we can't continue doing this. He said, what's the problem? I said, well, I can't pay you. I can't. And I was aware of the history of these men, these African-American men who were up in their 70s. Now, Bubba's in his 70s now, 70s and 80s, and not being compensated. So he looked at me. He said, look, he said, I don't want your money. But one day, somebody's going to look at you the way you looked at me about this art form. When you give to them everything I've given to you, you will have paid me in full.
Well,
that's why New Jersey Tap Ensemble was created, because it was part of a promise that I made to him that I would pass the art form on to the next generation. So that's, you know, so he's all, that's why I say he's always with me. And he told me, he said, the jump rope is going to take you around the world. And he was right. I did it in the Cotton Club. I did it with Cab on tour. I've done it everywhere. So, and my career actually was parallel to him. He got to see me in Black and Blue. He met Ken. He was a wonderful, and people ask me, what did Bubba teach me that I hold on to? And what he taught me the most was not the jump rope. It was life. He had been through so much, a segregated army. He had been overseas with blackballed because they couldn't read the fine print in their contracts, all kinds of things. When he got to New York, Bubba was very fair. He had green eyes, and he could what we call pass. And there was a producer who loved his dancing and said he wanted to hire him. And Bubba said, he told him, he said, well, I have an act. I'm not by myself. So the gentleman said, okay, well, we'll hire the act. When they met the act, the other two dancers were brown like me. And Bubba said, the gentleman said, well, Bubba, we can take you, but we can't take the other two boys. He said, well, if you don't take them, you don't get anybody. So, you know, this was a man who passed on to me all the trauma, and he was never what you would call, and Kenny met him, he was always positive, no matter what. A little story I'll never forget, I went to pick him up one day in New York. He lived right across from Central Park in Harlem, and I had my little car, and I parked it on the side of the street, being very naive and foolish. And when we went down, I went upstairs, knocked on his door. He said, okay, I'll be right out. He comes down. The car is gone. And I said, oh, my God, where is the car? Of course, it had been towed. So he said, what? He said, well, he said, let's find out where they towed it. I said, well, I can't get the car. I don't have. He said, let's go get the car. So I said, we found out it was $500. You know what he said? He said, well, I just hit the number. Easy come, easy go. Get the car.
You know, Debbie, I'm going to stop you. I'm going to stop you now because I realized that I could go on and listen to the stories that you and Ken have for the next hour or 2 hours. This is amazing. I mean, I have no questions to ask. I just want to hear the stories. But I have to. This is reality. This is radio time. So I only have.
We understand.
10 minutes left. I just want to, we have people here who have lined up. I just wanted to give those people an opportunity to ask you any questions that you they possibly can have, because they've been listening very quietly. I mean, the board is full, and they've been listening to this, and everybody's like, unbelievable. But I want to give them an opportunity before this portion of it closes out, because when we go to Zoom, it's just us in conversation, so no one can ask a question. So I just want to say, if you want to ask a question, please press the number one after you, because they're all on 516-453-6063. So they're here. But if you want to ask a question, press the number one, and we'll be able to do that right before we leave here. I cannot tell you how wonderful it is. It has been just to hear both of you, to hear the stories and to make that arc, how everything has happened for you. And you all did it that quick. Now, here comes the question. Here comes the question. All right. I'm going to let the person in. All right. Welcome to we've only got about 6 minutes left. Why don't you say your name, where you're from, and what your question is?
My name is Julius Hollingsworth, and I'm from Valley Stream, Long Island, right now. My question is, what project would you, that you're dreaming about in the next year, that you'd like to do with your company?
I'm so glad you asked that. I want to do a stop on the A train, which is a production about the Harlem Renaissance and how tap dancers were their contribution to the Harlem Renaissance. It was such a wonderful age in our country. And I think of today, there are all kinds of movements going on, but the Harlem Renaissance was one of the most brilliant that African-Americans and people of color really, really were part of. And I want to put it on the stage, but not only with tap, but also with some of the landmark facilities and places where that were so important during that time, like the Savoy Ballroom and Connie's Inn, many different places. So I want to bridge together poetry as well as some of the politics and, of course, tap dancing, which was phenomenal at that time, even though the Charleston and other forms of dance like the Lindy Hop were also powerful. But that's my dream. I really want to bring that to life.
Thank you, Julius. I think that's absolutely incredible. The one thing that I was going to ask, and I'm so glad that he brought that up, is where do you think tap is? Tap goes in and it becomes very popular, then it gets dormant a little bit, then it gets popular again. Yes. Where do you think we are right now, Debbie?
Right now, it has become one of the most powerful techniques and dance forms out there. Today, you cannot audition for almost anything without having a tap combination and a pair of shoes. It is now on Broadway, you know, with a new generation of dancers, mm-hmm. and Funny Girl, and it's phenomenal. Tap dancing today is global. And I think a lot of that has to do, of course, with the contribution of Mr. Savion Glover. He brought such a new generation along with the excitement and the history of the art form that today it is much more respected than it ever has been. But it is global, with not only here in the United States, there are almost in every country and, of course, throughout the United States. You can't go to a city without a tap festival being there or someone who is doing tap. It's now prominent in on television, so you think you can dance. America's Got Talent. Even a Miss America contestant, one of them that won, was a tap dancer. So yeah. It just goes to show, you're right, it goes in and out. But I think it has a grip on young artists today that it's not going anywhere but up.
I think so. What would you suggest to a young person now? And I mean, when I say young, I mean someone 7, 8, 9 years old who may have that feeling, or someone just a little bit older than them if they were thinking about getting into the business. What you and Ken get together and tell me that in 2 minutes. That's all you have. 2 minutes. What would you tell them to do?
study everything. Dance, voice, acting, do it all. Even if you are in love with one thing in particular, like tap, it won't take you possibly where you want to go in this business. You've got to know it all and know the business of the business. Didn't you think?
Yeah, I would say.
Your education is still important. And when I say education, I don't mean you have to literally have a degree, but you must know the ways of the world and know what may work and be realistic. Everybody's not going to be a star, and know that from the beginning. And life is not fair, especially in show business.
No, hooray, and hallelujah. One last word from you on that. What would you say to if a young person came up to you and said, "What do you think I should do?" All the things that Debbie said, do you have anything to add to what you would want them to carry with them through a career?
Your faith. What do you say? They need a strong faith.
I think one of the things that has helped us over a lot of things, of issues that we dealt with, is our faith.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever that faith is, whether you're Catholic, whether you're Jewish, whether you're
Buddhist, Islam,
any of the other believers in Christ, I think it's important to believe it and to live it.
And also, remember, you cannot do anything by yourself. You must have other people, and you get nowhere alone. Other people have to come to your aid and help you. I'm fortunate. I had a husband who came to my, but I also had friends. I had people like Lenny. I had people like Marie Thomas. I had people who believed in me. So you do have, you have to be discerning and understand. Everyone will not be your friend, but you do need the help of others. I could not be where I am today without it.
And amen to that. I tell you, we're going to continue this this wonderful conversation. I want to tell my audience we're down to the last about minute and a half. Next week, we're going to have some of the winners from the Bistro Awards. But this, we're going to continue on Zoom, and you'll be able to see that Zoom continuation on Facebook, on Twitter, on the YouTube, and then you can see it here again. So I'm going to say goodbye to you two for right now, and then I'll see you on Zoom in a few minutes. Thank you, everyone. Straight No Chaser, and we'll see you next week. I'll see you on the radio, and I'll see you two in a little bit on Zoom. Thank you.
Yes, you will. Okay.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever, when you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night. Listen to me, baby, hear every word I say. No one can love you the way I do, 'cause they don't know how to love you far away. You give me fever. In the morning.